From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 30th day of December 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the role Extension plays in translating the research done here on campus to the people of the state of Illinois, and how that's done, particularly through the FarmDoc series of websites. We'll do that with Jonathan Kappas, and then we'll pick up with one of those translations, roughly speaking, with Gary Schnitke, as he tries to help farmers think about how to deal with low-income years, the years that are now starting on the farm and may last for some time, and some strategies that they can deploy as it's related to their farm businesses. And we'll do all of that on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll begin today with Jonathan Kappas. He's a member of the FarmDoc team, the policy specialist, and has thought deeply about the role of FarmDoc and Extension. I asked him to tell me about FarmDoc.
FarmDoc is kind of our public engagement outreach project here in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics, where one of the main things we do is we write articles every workday. So we try to come up with, new and original material every workday of the week in which we're analyzing something. So my role is really to focus on federal policy, the farm bill, farm policy, and try to keep track of what's going on in Congress, work with some of my colleagues, the economists, on analyzing policy and getting a sense of what it means for farmers and sometimes just understanding, trying to understand. Sometimes it's hard to make sense out of everything that's going on, but try to get a sense of how things are unfolding or what things might happen and what that could mean for farmers and what some of the issues that we see on the ground with farmers and how that might impact the policy discussions and decisions. But it really, for my end of it, of the work, is really focused on the farm bill and the federal policy apparatus.
FarmDoc is a tool created by the agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. It is now 25 years old, very unique in that it takes research every business day of the year, that's 5 days a week, about 50 weeks out of the year, and translates it into a usable form for those bankers and farmers and others interested in agriculture. It is an enormous undertaking, and I'm sure you've heard this more often than not, that people are stunned by the amount of information the FarmDoc team is able to develop.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to it. It's a lot of fun. It's a challenge. I will say that probably the most important thing about it is there's a group of us that do this and work as a team. And it is invaluable to be able to walk down the halls and, get in an argument with Gary Schnitke about something. And then that can, turn into a FarmDoc article, or sit around with Nick Paulson and Gary and Bruce and sort of hammer out some ideas. Or, you see something in the news one day and it becomes, okay, what's so-and-so looking to do with this policy? And we can discuss it and work on it. So it is a lot of work. It's a big commitment, but at the same time, it's really an incredible kind of organic, rolling discussion and set of work that feeds into what we write, and what we write feedback into that. And at the same time, we get incredible feedback. We kind of joke that it may not be a peer review process that academics typically like, but it gets very quickly peer reviewed across the country, and we get feedback right away. Sometimes that feedback is, why didn't you look into this issue, or what about this? And again, can send us down onto another path of work and research and analysis. And so it is, I like to think of it as like, it is this sort of rolling conversation around issues of agriculture, issues of policy. And, it's been an incredible amount of fun and learning on the go. I'm not an economist, so I've had to learn at least how to argue with the economists sometimes, and how to try to understand how those economic issues apply to policy and what policy, how that feeds back into it. So it really is that group kind of effort that I think makes it tick and makes it work. and keeps it, you know, worth doing.
Personally, one of the things I find most interesting about PharmDoc is its ability to reach across state lines and to include researchers and academics from other institutions throughout the Midwest.
I think it's in the great tradition of what extension is, what has always been intended to do, which is to find ways to get research out into the public and into the public hands, whether those public hands are farmers needing to, you know, apply new production methods or running the economic numbers. And in the same sense, we get a chance to work with colleagues in other universities and other institutions to, you know, both gather feedback. So what's going on in Ohio? What's the story in California? But also to get their knowledge and work with them on a lot of these issues too. And so much like extension, right? We've got extension everywhere in this country for a reason, and it does an enormous amount of good in getting that knowledge and research and educational materials out into the public realm to be used and useful for the public. And so I think, again, in that tradition and with that kind of focus, which really I think is kind of a great a great collaboration, a great longstanding effort, and just another version of trying to do a lot of this of that work that we've seen for what now 110 years, I think we're at, yeah, with extension.
I do want one last thing from you as it relates to the history of extension, why it was put into place, and how it relates to science-based information.
Extension starts 110 years ago as very much trying to help, at that time, farmers who were in a much different production system and help them adopt new technology and new practices and all of the research that was going on at the time in the land grant system. And how do you get that into their hands to use it and not just tell you something, but show you and demonstrate and work with farmers so they can learn and understand. And as we all know, farmers love to tinker with these things. So how do they use it and learn through that process? And what you've seen with extension over that time is this growth. So kind of to your question, I mean, we've seen this pattern where, you know, you move to, you know, things about conservation, you move to issues of, you know, different types of farming. And now we're talking about the food assistance programs and healthcare and healthy eating issues. So it is a model that is extraordinarily adaptable, translating research. And we do, I'm still amazed after 10 years on this campus, the amount of research that even I come across, which is a sliver of it, right, it's just an immense amount of work and information and findings and the science and all of this. And so the model of extension, as modified a little bit by PharmDoc, is itself very adaptable because it is a translation effort to take the science and the research and find a way to make it useful and applicable in everyday life. And again, that's, you know, all the way back from when it was farm fields to now kitchens and doctor's offices. When these new diseases pop up, you need to be able to pull from that deep well of research and get it into the useful system that people have to deal with. And that is what extension, it was designed to do and does extraordinarily well on a much broader set of topics and issues than I think most people even realize how much gets worked on with schools and kids on the school lunch program and healthy eating habits and those sort of things. All of this has that kind of extension tie. And, you know, so one of the questions you asked a minute ago, which is how much more can be done? I mean, this can be adapted to everything that we have to work on and all the issues we have before us as a society, which makes it incredibly useful, but it's also not an easy undertaking. I mean, it is not an easy thing to translate some deep research into whatever the issue is of the moment or how to help somebody work through a new technology in a farm field or in their kitchen. But that's the kind of incredible work I think it gets done. You know, as an example of the kind of investments we need, the kind of capability to translate as new things come up. I mean, we're not that far from just living through that COVID mess as well. And we saw very clearly firsthand how that can disrupt lives, how that can disrupt everything we do. And so I think this is the kind of capability that is extraordinarily important as a society, because we invest a lot in research. We put a lot of effort in research. It's that level of really interpreting it and applying that research out in the real world, because that's where the day-to-day needs are going to be and continue to be. And adapting to that is a huge undertaking.
Jonathan Kopis is a member of the Farm Doc team. He specializes in agricultural policy here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. We're now joined by Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He, along with a series of the Farm Doc team, have penned an article for the Farm Doc Daily website entitled Perspectives and Strategies for Dealing with Low Farm Incomes in 2024 and Beyond. Essentially, Gary, this is just a way for farmers to think about making sure they're most cost-effective and efficient in very low-income years. Can you define for me what a low-income year or years might be for a farm?
Yes, which is a good question. I would say that agriculture, more often than not, is in a low-income year. So the last time we had a series of low-income years was like from 2015 to 2019. That came off high-income years, which happened to be 2012, when our prices were high because of drought and crop insurance payments. We also had higher above-average incomes in 21 and 22, and that has since fallen. And we are projecting a very low, a negative income, minus $30,000 per farm or below that for farms enrolled in FBFM for 2024. And that would happen to be the lowest since the 1980s. So we're going back a very long way in saying that this year will be a low income year.
Now, I have a question about the chart that you have related to net farm income in the article. It's from the FBFM and shows in $1,000, so that's why you're at negative $30,000 for this year. How many acres does it represent?
So this is grain farms enrolled in FBFM. The average grain farm size would be about 1,500 acres in this farm, and we have many farms that are lower than that. The lowest farm size in this sort would be 500 acres. We have farms in this sort that are over 10,000 acres. FBFM itself represents about 25% of the acres in Illinois, so it's a pretty good sample.
Yeah, so it shows the wide swing in income that farms can have from year to year. It can be.
Yeah, I mean, and those incomes, those swings are huge. If anything, they seem to be getting larger in recent years rather than previous years. So, you know, we had in 21 and 22, we had net farm incomes on these farms that were close to $500,000, and now we're below $30,000. And we sort of think that you have to have $100,000 of income just to sort of stay the same. So you have to have income to support family living, capital purchases, etc. So that minus 30 is well below the point where we're looking at maintaining the financial position. We will be eroding working capital in the current ratio, and we might actually also begin to see debt-to-asset ratios rise. So all those, again, it's a low income.
You asked the question, how long will low incomes last? Many producers are wanting to know that as well.
And I would say it's unpredictable, right? So, and which is not particularly profound, but it is true. So what's going to cause us to come out of this low income period will be, generally, you would expect it to be a rise in commodity prices. And the events that could cause that are impossible to predict. We came, you know, 2020, we began to go into a high income period that was prompted by a derecho storm in Iowa, a hog build in China, and Ukraine-Russia conflicts. And I mean, predicting those in the future is difficult. Standing here right now, you look at the world and you say there's difficulties brewing in the Middle East that could have an impact on prices, a wider war. So there are things that could cause prices to either come up or to come down. But yeah, they're unpredictable. And I always keep looking at Brazil and remembering that they have a whole lot of land that they can still bring on in production. So there's sort of a cap on our high prices. And whenever we see prices rise and profitability rise, we can expect another larger part of land from Brazil to come on into production and stay there.
So the last couple of sets, the low incomes have lasted what, 10 years from 95 to 05, and then what, from 12 to 17 or 18?
So they can last up to 10 years, and
You write in the article about some strategies that you and your colleagues believe farmers can use to help them deal with these low returns. I think it's important to start with the one that they probably cannot use. And that's just plain outright marketing or trying to hit a home run when they're marketing their crops.
So our first strategy is realize there's no way out of a way to market yourself out of low returns because we have low prices, and there's not much evidence that farmers can time market sales. So in fact, there's negative evidence to that impact. And if you can time market sales, just time market sales and don't bother raising the crop. But and that's difficult. There are some ways to differentiate oneself by producing differentiated grains like non-GMO or food grade corn, and using on-farm storage for post-harvest marketing opportunities is also a reasonable strategy. Some farmers will find that either one of those isn't their way to go, and they can make that decision quite reasonably. Just generally, low incomes, low prices are here to stay, and we would suggest something along spreading marketing sales across the year. So you're not going to hit a high, you're not going to hit a low, you're going to hit the average. But that's generally it. That strategy will reduce risk.
So what can they do? What are the things that you and your colleagues have identified beyond the couple of things you've mentioned, GMO and diversification, food grade corn, those sorts of things? What other kinds of things can they do?
And we would say that all these are straightforward, well known, and yet difficult to implement. So just so we set that up, one is to be a low cost producer, and we do looking at FBFM farms, see differences in costs that persist over time. And those farms that have lower cost on either however you measure it per acre per bushel typically have higher returns. Some of the things we would sort of say look at now is particularly look at fertilizer applications, make sure we're in university levels, realize that fungicides now have to have more yield to justify their application, so maybe take a look at those. And overhead machinery are other areas where we see farms have differences in cost. Our next strategy would be to take every government payment that's out there. We know that some farmers don't particularly appreciate those, but if you're particularly if you're a young producer, you're placing yourself at a disadvantage. So make up we sure we sign up for ARC and PLC. Those deadlines are March 15th. We would suggest taking crop insurance at a high level, RP at a high level, and think about taking ECO and SCO this year and take a look at that. That's not a slam dunk, but take a look at those items. Delay capital purchases. Finally, also develop them. Farm rental strategy, and this is particularly important for younger producers. Make sure that that farm is well known in the community, have a farm resume and talking points for differentiating oneself, but also determine what you're going to pay for cash rent. Cash rents are up there, and it sometimes it taking a high cash rent couldn't can dis Picking a farmland and paying a high cash rent can actually destabilize a farm. I'd also suggest preparing a cash flow, find another source of income, which is another thing that most farmers have done, some sort of off-farm income or off-farm business. Many farms have a great deal of business acumen, entrepreneurship on that farm. Think about those other businesses. Finally, and this may seem counterintuitive, build in the expectation for buying farmland in the future. When we look at farms today, the ones that are most financially solid are those that have a land base. And that's just the way it is. So over time, we should be thinking about increasing that own land base. That's always difficult. We're not saying that there's not a chance that farmland prices decline, but building in that expectations is something that we think producers need to think about, even in these times. I mean, that farmland does make that farming operation more secure when it's paid for.
I think you had a couple of suggestions about the things people and farmers needed to do when they were going to plan for that as well. Do they need to have capital set aside?
Yeah, so we're obviously, if we're going to do a purchase farmland, we have to have financial resources to do so. If you're a young producer, think about taking advantage of FSA loan programs, which can lower the interest rate. And in general, no matter if it's debt financed at over 50%, and may in fact be lower than that, the repaying the debt is going to be a cash outflow for the first several years. So having some other source of funds to cover that land purchase is important as well.
Couple of things for this fall that producers can take care of. You mentioned anhydrous ammonia and fertilizer applications. In-rate calculator is what you search for on the web. That's in-rate calculator. You're looking for actually a site that is entitled cornratecalc.org. And then, of course, we've not mentioned this, but you would argue, I'm sure, that they need to talk about cash rents with their landowners.
Yep. I mean, again, those cash rental discussions are difficult, but we saw cash rents on average go up $40 since between 2020 and 2024. Coming down to the 2020 levels would be, in my mind, good, but that's still not going to get us to a profitable return. We need to have those cash rents go down below that, given our projections. So we'll see what happens. But yes, beginning those discussions would be a good thing.
Thank you much. I appreciate it, Gary.
You're welcome, Todd.
Gary Schnitke is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. You may read more from him on the FarmDoc website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You've been listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Monday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Do visit us online at willag.org.